Hi, everybody. My name is Stritton, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
How you like me so far? It's really good to be here tonight. I want to thank Mark for the invitation. It's always an honor and a privilege to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes it doesn't feel like an honor and a privilege. Sometimes it feels like a long time in the car with these guys. But by continuing to show up and to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous, I like the results of my life. I like the fact that I will probably go to bed tonight without having whiskey on my breath. So it's a privilege to be out here with you guys. And thank you, Raphael, for your 10-minute talk. Thank you so much. I told him just before he came up here, be honest or tell the truth. And he did. He ratted himself out about not finishing the steps yet. So that was good. And then we've got a little crew here. So it's I want to thank Kevin for driving us up. And our sponsor, Dan, is here. And this is cool. So Dan sponsors Kevin and I. Kevin sponsors Eric. I sponsor Raphael. Raphael sponsors Brevin. So it's our little family. We're all here. So thank you guys for being here tonight. And if you're new, I want to say welcome. Welcome to this life-saving, life-changing place. And, you know, a couple of... Betsy that had a birthday. I'm a couple weeks late, but I tried to be up here for your birthday. It didn't work out. We had other stuff going on, but happy birthday to Betsy. And then Melissa, thank you for that warm welcome. Thank you all for that warm welcome. You have a pocket of enthusiasm up here at this group, and I love it. I like the new building, and you just have it's a very warm, welcoming group to walk into, and I thank you for that. And again, if you're new, I welcome you. So I told you about my sponsor. I've got Dan as my sponsor. I've got a home group, which is the Inland Group, which was mentioned. We meet at 7:30 on Monday nights in Redlands. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you. It's a great group with some structure, but really warm, welcoming group. And then last but not least, on October 4th, 2006, I was given the greatest gift that a guy like me could ever hope for. And that's, of course, my sobriety date. By no means is that my first sobriety date, but I pray to God that it's my last. So if you're new, I'm just asked to come up here and share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. So in the next, I don't know, how long do I talk? What time do I start? Okay. So in the next 40 minutes or 45 minutes, I'm going to get drunk, burn my life to the ground, and get sober. And hopefully be well on the road of happy destiny by the time we leave here. I'll try. So I was raised in a trailer park. Any other trailer park kids here? Oh, I feel like I'm at home. It's funny, I always do that. I like to just feel the room out. I don't know, a year ago or so, I was speaking at a roundup in Ridgecrest, was it? And I asked that question, like, everybody raised their hand. Like, I'm putting in a change of address. I'm moving to Ridgecrest. But like 2 weeks before that, I spoke at Beverly Hills, and I asked that question. Not a single hand went up. So, yeah, I come from the trailer park. I came from a broken home. My parents got divorced when I was 2 months old. And so I was off to a rough start. And I don't know, I looked around. It seemed like everybody else had a mom and a dad, and I didn't. And I would go long periods of time without seeing my dad. And, you know, when my parents got married in 63, I think it was, my dad was this young Paul Newman looking guy, James Dean looking guy, clean cut. And in 1970, when I was born, he looked more like one of the Doobie Brothers. And he had gone into this hippie lifestyle, and he wanted to move and live in communes and travel and smoke dope and do whatever he was doing. And that's not what my mom had envisioned for her life. And so they divorced, and so I grew up really confused. Like, we had this picture on the wall at home of my dad. They said, that's my dad. Looked like James Dean or something. And then I had this guy that would walk up, and I'm like, well, I thought it was two different people. I was so confused, and I would go months or years at a time without seeing him. And I was always really confused about that. And I never felt like I was raised to think he's the enemy. I heard nothing but bad things about this man. So I grew up thinking he's the enemy. And I never felt safe. Like, I really wanted a relationship with my dad. I think every kid does. And, You know, but I didn't feel safe to say, hey, I really want to know my dad. I really want to see my dad. Because he's the enemy. So I never felt like I could talk about that. So I just went along with the theme in the house that, you know, we didn't need him. We didn't care about him. And like I said, everybody else seemed like everybody had nicer shoes, nicer cars, nicer home. Their homes weren't on axles like mine was. And I just felt cheated from the start, man. I just always felt cheated. And, you know, for a long time, I would tell you that when you would ask me why I drank so much or you know, what's wrong with me. And I would tell you this tale about this difficult life I'd had. If you grew up without a dad like me, and, you know, if you grew up in the trailer park, and I would tell you that to explain why I did the things I was doing. And today I tell you that, but not for that reason. I tell you because when I was 13 years old, I found the solution to all of it. I found that first drink, man. I found that first drink. And I don't even have a word to really describe how profound that was. It was like drinking magic for me. I mean, the book says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I think that has got to be the biggest understatement in that book. I don't like the effect produced by alcohol. I am in love with the effect produced by alcohol. Like just that, I mean, I just get the chills thinking about it now. It solved every problem I ever had. It solved problems I didn't even know I had until I drank it. And I wasn't one of those, I'm 13 years old. I'm not one of those people that drank socially for a period of time and then crossed this invisible line. Like from the gate, like give me more. I want more of that. And so I was pretty much from the start, I'm a daily drinker. I you know, every day I'm drunk. My mom's coming home, finding me passed out on the couch on a daily basis at 5 o'clock. And, you know, I'm hanging out at the liquor store to find the biker guy that'll buy us the beer. You know, we'll kick him a couple and he gives us the rest. We're hitting our friends' parents' liquor cabinets. I would drink things like vanilla extract, mouthwash, cough syrup, you name it, I drank it. And anything to give me that sense of ease and comfort. And I remember being like 14 years old, standing in my bathroom, drinking shots of NyQuil, chasing it with Listerine. Not exactly social drinking. Some people call it desperation. I call it happy hour. And it worked. I would drink anything I could get my hands on. And so right away I'm having problems. You know, we always hear that. It's fun, you know, it's fun, and then it's fun with problems, and then it's problems. And I was to that fun with problems stage really quick. And to the problems phase really quick, too. And, you know, so leading up to that, I kind of followed the rules. I did okay in school. I'd come home when the streetlights came on like I was supposed to. I kind of followed the rules. And when I started drinking, all the rules went out the window, man. It was like flipping a switch. My whole life changed. I start smoking and drinking and chasing girls. And I like my whole life changed. Start, you know, acting up in school, become the class clown. I'm getting in trouble in school. And my mom's really concerned. She keeps trying to get me to go to treatment, telling me I'm an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, I'm 13, I'm 14. I didn't even think it was possible. So I continued on like that. And so I said this wasn't my first sobriety date. I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987. It was just before my 17th birthday. And specifically what was going on at that time, I had gotten kicked out of my high school for drinking Boone's Farm out of my locker one too many times. And any other Boone's Farms drinkers here? Oh, everybody? All right. I just like to know I'm home, so. And the thing about that is I had grown up in Yucaipa. I went to school with the same kids since kindergarten. And now I'm in high school, and I'm looking forward to that day walking down, you know, walking the stage and getting my diploma with these kids that I knew my whole life. And now I'm kicked out of my high school. I don't get to walk that stage. I'd had a couple of girlfriends break up with me, and the only thing they said is, you're drunk every time I see you. You know, and I like these girls. I liked them a lot. But already at that age, if you get between me and a drink, then you got to go. And I'd had some run-ins with the law a couple times, you know, underage drinking or drunk in public or whatever. I was just having a lot of problems. And so when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was a Saturday morning. I had taken my mom's car out on a Saturday morning. I was drinking all morning, and I wrecked her car. And I thought, well, now's probably a good time to take up her offer to go to treatment. Did I think I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows, or was I sick and tired of being sick and tired? No, none of that is true. I didn't know how else to get the heat off, so I went home and I said, Mom, you're right, I need help. And by the way, your car's wrecked. And I was checked into an adolescent treatment program that night at Redlands Hospital and introduced to kids that are like me, that were doing the things I was doing. And within a few days, they put us in those white vans and brought me to meet you. And I am so grateful they did that. Unfortunately, I had a lot of years of drinking ahead of me. I didn't know it then, but I had a lot of years of drinking ahead of me. But I started hearing the music in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started hearing your stories, and I started identifying just a little bit. You know, there was more that I didn't identify with, because I'm 17. I haven't ever been married. I haven't lost a family like you have. I haven't been to prison. I haven't done all the things, but I started identifying a little bit. And I always knew where to come back to, and I always like to throw this in there, because I hear a lot of people talk about their experience when they first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, they were told to sit down and shut up, or, you know, thumped in the chest. That was never my experience, just not my experience. I was always treated very kindly, and I was always told to keep coming back. And I told this a few weeks ago, at every meeting, I'm like the first guy, every participation meeting, I'm the first guy with his hand up to share, thinking that I had a lot, and I'm like, Trenton Alcoholic, I've been through the desert on a horse with no name, like sharing complete nonsense, like absolute nonsense, and they would just clap and say, keep coming back, kid, and I'm really grateful for that. It felt like a safe place to come back to, and I'm really grateful that's the way they treated me. So while I'm in this treatment center, you know, they had a lot of suggestions, and I'm sure you've heard them. Get a book, get a sponsor, work the steps. My personal favorite, no relationships in the first year. I'm 53, I'm still not listening to that nonsense. And at 17, I was just like, you could just kill me now, man. You've taken away the booze, now the girls? Okay, all right. There's some hope for you. And so, of course, within about 30 days, I met the girl that was to become my wife. And she wasn't an alcoholic. She was, her dad was an alcoholic, and she wanted nothing to do with drinking. And so here I am, sober guy. And we were young, and we fell in love like crazy in love, man. We had a relationship like I've only seen in the movies. And just young and crazy in love, inseparable. So much so that within a couple of months, she informed me I was going to be a dad. So now I'm newly sober, 17, baby on the way. And so my idea is, you know, we're going to get married and have this baby and live happily ever after. And I think this drinking problem is solved. You know, I've got, you know, some months now. You know, at that young age, if you take me and put me in a hospital setting and put me in a lot of meetings and I sit on my hands, I'm able to stop drinking, you know, at that age. And I certainly believe I was alcoholic, but I was, you know, not to that stage yet. It was pretty easy to stop, and I thought that problem solved, and I'm ready to get on with this life. And so, you know, we did get married and had our daughter, and so now I'm a year sober, so I don't really need to go to meetings anymore because that problem solved, and I don't have time. I got this young family to take care of. So, you know, about a year sober, I got this brand new daughter at home, and I went to work one day, and somewhere between work and home, I'm drunk. I never planned it. I never saw it coming. And I'm drunk, and I got home, and that's not what this young wife of mine signed up for. And she's scared to death, and within a couple of days, that family car sitting in an impound lot because I got a DUI. And the job's gone, and I'm disappearing for 2, 3, 4 days at a time because that's what happens when I drink. It's never my intention, but it's what happens when I take a drink. And I don't know how long I drank that time. I think it was 2 or 3 months. All I know is I drank right up until I thought she was going to leave me. When I thought she was going to leave, I ran back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that started this cycle that for the next 18 years, I would go in and out of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying from alcoholism. Dying from alcoholism. Dying from alcoholism and didn't even know I had it. Like there was a guy that lived behind the liquor store by my house. He lived behind the liquor store, drank out of a paper sack. That's an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. And I suffer from that obsession that the book talks about, that somehow, someday, I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. I was, like, what it does for me, I would chase that and chase that and chase that. And over those 18 years, it was just like you'd expect. It was, you know, jails and hospitals and treatment centers and getting fired for showing up at 8 o'clock in the morning drunk. and my job and just that life that we live. Sometimes I would get 30 days sober and get drunk. Sometimes I'd get a couple of years and get drunk. And just over and over and over. Never treating my alcoholism. Treating a drinking problem. Treating a drinking problem by coming in here, as they used to say, putting the plug in the jug. And I would sit here until I couldn't sit here anymore. I would get so uncomfortable. I'd get what the book talks about. Restless, irritable, discontented. I'd get a resentment and I'd have to drink at you. I'm going to show you. And I would go drink again. And I was always a ticking time bomb. And the longest stretch I ever went, and I hesitate to call it sobriety, but I didn't drink for just short of 7 years. And during that 7 years, my life got really good. I was coaching my kids in sports. My wife and I had a nice home. I had started a business that was having some success. And, you know, like I said, coaching my kids in sports, my life got really good over that 7 years. And now, you know, I'm showing up to AA on my birthday. Go take a cake and show the newcomer that it works. And you don't see me for another year. At the end of that 7 years, just short, like 2 weeks before, I would have been seven. My wife and I were going to a party one night, and I never saw this woman drunk ever. She would, like occasionally at a wedding, she would have a toast or something. But just out of respect for me, and she didn't care about drinking, she just didn't drink. And we're going to a party this night, and on the way there, she said, "Hey, do you mind if I get some wine coolers for the party?" And I said, "Sure, no problem." We stop and we get her. They sell these things in a four-pack. Four-pack. We bought one four-pack. Why would you have one four-pack? I can't buy one 18-pack. I buy two. We buy her one four-pack, go to the party. Even worse, at the end of the night, there were two left in the four-pack. And yet, I'm the one with a drinking problem. We put them in the trunk of the car and forgot about them. A couple weeks goes by, and she and I are in our living room one night, and we have an argument. Just an argument like husbands and wives sometimes have. But it started to get a little bit loud, a little heated, so I decided to walk outside and just let things calm down. And while I'm out on my front porch, I just remember the wine coolers. Just a passing thought, I remember the wine coolers in the trunk of the car. I hadn't been thinking about drinking. I thought that is behind me. I'll never drink again. I didn't think I was at risk for it. It was a passing thought. And the next thing I know, I'm over there putting my key in the trunk of that car, tipping back a wine cooler. 7 years gone, just like that. 7 years gone. If you're new, we have a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous: pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I think blowing 7 years on a Bartles and James wine cooler is exactly what they mean. It's my belief. It's my belief. No sponsor, no steps, no service, no chance. No chance for a guy like me. And what I didn't understand when I took that drink, that I have the phenomenon of craving. I don't know what that is. I don't know anything about it. I've never read the book. I've come and just sat in meetings. I'd never read the book and read that part where it talks about this allergy of the body that I seem to have, that when I take a drink, I can't stop. So within about 15 minutes of that Bartles and James wine cooler, I'm standing at the liquor store buying that big bottle of vodka, 18-pack of beer. 2 weeks from that Bartles and James wine cooler, I'm being stuffed into the back of a police car, DUI number 4. Because that's what happens when I drink. And over the next 3 years, I drank like the only description that I've ever heard that really described it was by Dr. Bob. He described it as that frightful drinking. Because that's what I did for the next 3 years. Always in the past when things would get bad or I'd get another DUI or she's going to leave me, whatever it was, I would come back to meetings and I'd stop drinking. And this time when I was given those ultimatums or those threats, I'd want to stop drinking and I'd come to a meeting and then I'd stop at the bar. Couldn't stop drinking. I learned what it meant to drink against my own will. Day in and day out making those promises. Promises that I meant with everything in me. My friend Kelly, I think, says it best. I love what she says. Drinking behind my own back. That's what I was doing for the next 3 years. And it got really, really bad. To kind of wrap up my drinking, I said I got that DUI, the fourth DUI. Well, you know, of course you know. You lose your license. I lost my license. The business that I had started during that 7 years was a towing business. Driver's license helps for that. And my biggest customers were San Marino County Sheriff's Department and Riverside Sheriff's Department. I had contracts to tow for the Sheriff's Departments. Now I can't even drive my own tow trucks. I went to court on that DUI, and Redlands, the courthouse and the police department used to be in the same parking lot. So I parked around the corner thinking I'm outsmarting the cops. They're not going to know that I'm driving. I go into that courtroom at 8 o'clock, whatever it is in the morning, and I left there convicted for DUI number 4. In terms of my probation, we're, I knew I couldn't drive, but not to be in possession or under the influence of alcohol. This big, long list about I couldn't even be in a business whose sole function is sales of alcohol. I left that courtroom. Now, the problem drinker we read about in the book, the heavy drinker, the problem drinker, if they haven't quit by now, fourth DUI, they're probably not going to get there, but fourth DUI, they're stopping. But what about the real alcoholic? I left that courtroom at 8:30, and I drove right around the corner to the Tartan Bar because they make a really good Bloody Mary. Another thing that happened during that 3 years, I had landed in Loma Linda Hospital one night, wheeled into the emergency room after a bar fight, and I had a liver condition that direct result of my drinking. Nothing else causes it. Condition with my liver. I'm being wheeled into the ER, and I'll never forget this ER doctor stood over me and she said, "If you don't soon stop drinking, you're going to die." And then a little while later, she came in back into the room after I was back inside there. And she, just fighting back tears herself. She's a doctor. She sees this stuff day in and day out. But she was really emotional. And she said, "I was just out there talking to your wife and your kids. They need you. And you're going to die." She was really clear. And I was admitted to the hospital. And I was there for 3 or 4 days. And they were able to get me kind of stabilized. And then I had a follow-up appointment I was supposed to go to a day or two later to follow up and see what I needed to do going forward with this liver condition. And I went to that appointment. It was, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I showed up that morning. And here's what the doctor said. The doctor said, "You're a young man and otherwise good health. If you stop drinking now, you'll probably never even know you had this problem." The doctor said, "If you stop now, you'll probably never even know you had this problem." What did I hear that doctor say? "It's not that bad yet. It's not that bad yet." Drove to the first liquor store when I left that doctor's appointment. My wife and my kids and my grandmother and my whole family that had been sitting at my bedside in that hospital room for days, not knowing what's going to happen with me. The next time my wife saw me, I was laying on the couch, passed out with a bottle of whiskey. I hope I never forget the amount of pain that I caused the people that love me the most when I take a drink. Above everything, I hope I never forget that. I'm sure for a long time I told myself I'm only hurting myself. You know, we tell ourselves that lie. I was breaking their hearts. You know, I would get sober and I'd coach their sports. I go to work every day. I help around the house. I help my kids with their homework. I do all that stuff. And then I take a drink. You know, I get their hopes up over and over and over, and they think, okay, maybe this time he's got it. And then I don't show up for dinner. And then I don't show up for breakfast. Over and over and over. And I hope I never forget that. And I did tell you I was going to be sober by the end of this. I better do it pretty quick here. So during that period of time, my wife found Al-Anon. And I don't know if there's any Al-Anons in the room. I always like to acknowledge the Al-Anons, because if it weren't for the program of Al-Anon, I would not be standing in this podium tonight. It was the example I saw right there in my own home of the 12 steps working in her life that brought me to my knees. Always in the past, she would fight with me about my drinking. Well, that's a good excuse to go out the door. Like, who wants to listen to that? And now she stops fighting with me. She doesn't mention my drinking. She treated me with nothing but love and compassion. And my own guilt and shame and remorse just brought me to my knees. And so when I started this talk, I said October 4th, 2006 was a gift. I described it as a gift because it's absolutely a gift. I didn't pick that date. I didn't know that was going to be the date. Our mutual friend Larry T, I think, says it best. He says his last drunk wasn't his worst one. It's just the one that drank away the debate. October 3rd was just another night of drinking. And just before I had gotten sober, just before that morning, I had gotten to that place where the book talks about it, where I was ready to go on and just drink myself to death. I was getting pretty hopeless and desperate, and I had gone to my wife and I said, hey, you're too good for this. Why don't you just leave me? I'm ready to just go on and drink myself to death, giving up. And I'll never forget her response. She looked at me with the sweetest look I've ever seen in a person's face. And she said, it's because I love you. And she started patting me on the center of the chest, and she said, I know what's in here is good. And she said, in my vows, I said, in sickness and in health, and I'll never leave you for being sick. And then she went on to describe how lonely it was. She talked about how it was to lay in that bed at night. A married woman laying in that bed all alone, waiting for that knock at the door. 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, can't get to sleep because you're waiting for that knock at the door. She talked about how she would rehearse it in her head, like, how am I going to explain it to our kids what happened to their dad? She said, do you know what it's like to get up and go to work every morning, get 2 kids ready for school, get them fed, make sure their clothes are clean, they got their homework in their backpacks, and get them off to school, make sure they get home safe from school, come home, help them with their homework, get them fed, get them bathed, get them to bed, and then lay at that bed at night and just tremble, and sometimes call the jails and hospitals looking for you. She talked about how it was to be married to a guy like me. And she said, but I'll never leave you for being sick. And, you know, after that, it's like I continued to drink for a little while, but I just couldn't drink those words away. I couldn't drink that look on her face away. There's not enough booze out there to drink that away. And so October 4th, that morning, I woke up in my own home. And I don't know, it was a profound experience for me. It was like I just woke up and I remembered things that I had long since forgotten. Just random things like what it felt like to wake up on a concrete floor behind bars and not even know what the charges were because I'd been in a blackout. I can't count the times that happened. Happened many times. That morning, I remember a few weeks before that, I had woken up and found a note slid under my bedroom door. And when I opened that note, you know, still drunk and hungover from the night before, when I opened that note, in the writing of a child, it says, Daddy, please stop drinking. I'm scared. It's my baby girl, man. It's my baby girl begging me to stop drinking because I'm scaring her. Another thing I remember that morning is I was always really, really close to my grandmother. We were super close. And the reason for that is when I was growing up in that trailer park as a kid, it wasn't just that it was a trailer park. The electricity would get shut off and stay off for months at a time sometimes. We didn't have dinner on the table at 5 o'clock. It was like not a great place for a kid to grow up. It was filthy and it just wasn't a good place to grow up. But my grandma's house was always clean and there was always dinner on the table and she never told me no. She never told me no. She would always come get me and she always made me feel safe. And we just stayed very close my whole life. And that morning, October 4th, I remembered what it felt like to see my grandmother on the other side of a thick piece of glass talking to me on a filthy county phone. I remember the heartbreak in her eyes. That woman had no business anywhere near a facility like I was in, and there she was visiting me. And so I decided that morning to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and try it one more time. And I hope I never forget, that morning I laid in that bed and I begged to God that I didn't even believe in for one day sober. Begged him for one day sober. I don't even believe in him and I'm begging him for one day sober. I would have given anything not to see that look in my wife's eyes or my kids' eyes ever again. I didn't want to hurt those people. I'm doing something on a daily basis that I don't want to do, hurting people that I never wanted to hurt every day. And that morning I would have done anything. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't drink that day. And then it was a week and then it was a month. And it was always my experience that when I'm able to stop and come back and see you, my life, the circumstances get better. And that's what was happening this time. But this time when I was 5 months sober, that wife of mine was diagnosed with cancer. And that's not how this is supposed to go. A long story short, I was 5 months sober when she was diagnosed, and when I was 9 months sober, she passed away. And I didn't take a drink. I'm a guy that takes a drink over every nickel and dime excuse you could ever come up with, and I walked through that experience and I didn't take a drink. It was always my dream to be a good husband and a good dad. That's all I ever really wanted to be. And believe me, I wanted to do it a lot longer than I got to do it. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be a really good husband to my wife at the time that she needed me the most. And I got to be present and there for my kids to walk through them through that experience when they really needed me. So when Mark calls and says, can you come up to Lancaster on a Friday night? The answer is yes. You need me to stack the chairs, make the coffee, whatever it is. I have a debt here that I can never repay. It's a privilege. When I say it's a privilege, it is. After my wife passed away, it was like my life crumbled, man. All I could do was go to 2 or 3 meetings a day, every day. I was scared to death of drinking, so I just came and sat in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor then, Gary P. I met Kevin, who was also sponsored by Gary at the time. And those guys just pulled me in the middle. They got me into the book. We were doing a book study. Joe and Charlie got me into the steps, got me into service. Gary used to always tell me, make sure you have a newcomer in your car. Always had newcomers in my car. It just got me in the middle of AA. And you know, during that time, so I'm focused on is staying sober and trying to be the best dad I could possibly be. And so that business I had to close the doors on it. They foreclosed on my home. They repossessed my cars. I went completely broke. But I went broke sober, man. I went broke sober, and that's all I really cared about. It was devastating, don't get me wrong. The whole thing. I was grieving. I was devastated. But I was sober. And I knew that I could, all those things, it could get better. And after about a year, I start trying to rebuild my life and got a new job and making decent money. And my kids and I had rented a little house. And life was starting to look a little bit better. And the only thing I really needed was to add a relationship. So I met somebody, we started dating, and we had the sickest, most tumultuous love-hate, even by AA standards. Sickest relationship. We were entertaining. And then we got married. And I really got sober late in this, so I got to hurry up. During that 6 years, I was lied to, I was lied about, I was cheated on, and I walked on eggshells day in and day out. I would go to meetings, and I was doing book study, doing all the things that I was asked to do and what I thought was right in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'm going home to an environment that nobody should live in. But I couldn't let go. I just couldn't let go. And I continued in that relationship. You know, I would like, that's it, we're breaking, it's it. We'd have another one of those blow-up fights, it's leaving forever. And then one more set of apologies, one more set of promises. And I go back thinking, this time it's going to be different. And finally, after 6 years of living like that, I woke up one day and I said, I didn't get sober to feel like this. And I was able to walk away. My favorite saying as a result of that, and I've got little posters all over my house and my car that say it, let go or get dragged. Because I had been getting dragged for a long time. And I left that relationship riddled with resentments. Our book says that resentments are the number one offender for the alcoholic. And I don't want to drink, man. I know that I have to overcome these resentments. And I'm taking the direction of a sponsor. I'm writing the inventories. I'm doing all these things. And I was, my buddy Pat says that I put on the AA clown suit and wore it for a while. I did not make this look pretty, man. I was a mess. Like, people would ask me at the meeting, hey, how are you doing? I would tell them. I'd be prepared for a long talk. And I'm trying so hard to overcome these resentments, and I just can't seem to do it. Like, I'm losing weight. I can't eat. I can't sleep. Every waking thought was about her and what she did. And her. And I'm like, what, these inventories, I'm told to write this inventory. And, you know, look at that part. Where are your, you know, that fourth column? And I'm doing it, and I'm like, I'm getting no relief at all, man. But I continue to take that direction. And finally, after months of writing these inventories, I was writing one more inventory, convinced it wasn't going to work. And I got to that fourth column, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, I was a grieving widower when she came along and made it all feel better. How much fear was I in when she came in? Like, how am I going to raise these kids alone? I was only 36 when I became a widower, but I felt like I'm going to die a lonely old man. My fear talking to me. How am I going to raise these kids alone? I always thought that when they told me to get to that fourth column, like they want me to see how I somehow caused her to cheat or I deserved it or something. And when I realized, when I had that little realization, I thought, where have I made decisions based on self that placed me in a position to be hurt? That's all they wanted me to see. Like let's be clear about it. The red flags were all there from day one. Little green spray paint, and I painted them all up green and just went for it. When I had that realization, that resentment that was keeping me awake at night started melting away. And it didn't happen overnight, but it started happening there. And it's been, I haven't seen her now in about 10 years or whatever it is, I don't know. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to go meet her for lunch. But I can tell you that I have absolutely no ill feelings towards her whatsoever. And if I was to see her on the street today, I could wish her well and mean it. Like I genuinely hope she's doing well. That day was never going to come. I come here thinking, like, with one hope, begging a God that I don't believe in for one day sober. I had no idea what was in store, how much change has happened in my life and in the lives of my kids. And so I got to share something. Now that I've scared all the newcomers out of AA, there's a happy ending to this, and I usually get sober quicker. I apologize for being so late on this. But in the last 17 years, I have had so many things that have happened in my life that I so wouldn't want to miss. Like the day that I got to walk my little girl down the aisle at her wedding. I'm one drink away from missing it. A few months after my daughter got married, she came over to my house and she handed me this gift bag, and it wasn't my birthday or anything, but I opened this bag and there was a card in there. When I opened the card, it said, "Congratulations, Grandpa." Let me know I'm going to be a grandfather. And when I read that card, I thought of one of my dear friends and an absolute hero of mine in AA was Patty O. And when she would speak, she would always talk about being in the room when her grandson Eden was born. And when she looked into his eyes, she was looking into the eyes of God. It was beautiful the way she told that story. So when I read that card, I'm like, 9 months from now, I'm going to be looking into the eyes of God like Patty was. And I was like pacing the floor for 9 months. And 9 months later, my phone rings. My daughter said, "Dad, it's time." And I beat her to the hospital. And I was the first person to hold my grandson, Logan. I was the first person to hold Logan after his parents. And when they put him in my arms, I'm ready for that patio moment. And I look into his eyes, and I look into his eyes. I mean, he's got great eyes, don't get me wrong. They're great. There's nothing wrong with his eyes. But it's like it's not the eyes of God. And I was I was extremely grateful to be there and to hold my grandson. I was grateful. It was beautiful. But at the same time, there was no disappointment in him. The disappointment was in me. I thought, how come these other people have these experiences, this connection to this higher power, and I don't get it? And then for a brief second, I thought, wait, Patty O lied. And I kept struggling with it, and then I just happened to glance over at my daughter. And I saw the way that my daughter was looking at me, standing there holding her son. And when I looked into my daughter's eyes, I was looking right square into the eyes of God. And I looked back at Logan, and I was looking into the eyes of God. I'm one drink away from missing it. About 5.5 years ago, my son was also getting married, and he came over and gave me a gift bag. And I opened it up, and he had a plaque made, and there was a picture of him and I when he was small. And then a current picture, and in the writing it said, "The only thing better than having you as my dad is having you as my best man." Because I come here and I write some inventories, and I stack some chairs, and I pray even though I feel like it's going nowhere. And I put on a collared shirt at my home group, and I do some things that they don't make any sense to me. I don't see how they're going to fix any of these problems. But as a result of doing that, I get to be my son's best man at his wedding. How do you get from that place? How do you get from a jail cell and a blackout, not knowing what the charges were, to standing there at your son's side at his wedding being his best man? I'm one drink away from missing it. And I repeat that a lot. I repeat it a lot, not because it's just some catchy little phrase. I repeat it because I am crystal clear on the fact that I am one drink away from missing everything good and decent in my life. My life is so full of those experiences in the last 17 years, like over and over and over. And I talk a lot about my family, and I do it because I think our families suffer the worst of our illness. They deserve the best of our recovery. And a couple more stories, and then I'll sit down. So when I was about 2 years sober, my grandmother that I mentioned earlier, she was getting older. She was in her 90s, and she couldn't see too good anymore. And I just thought, man, she's getting up there. And I just wanted to spend all the time I could with her. So my kids and I started this thing where once a week we would pick her up and take her to dinner. And we did that, picked her up one night, and we got out of the car going up on the sidewalk. I didn't want her to trip because she couldn't see too good. So I didn't think anything of it. I just reached out and held her hand to help her up on the sidewalk. And when I did that, she looked up at me and she squeezed my hand and she said, whenever you're around, I feel safe. Because of you, my 93-year-old grandmother got to feel safe. And I just love that I have that drunk experience of seeing her visiting me in a county jail. And then couple years sober, and look at the difference, man. Look at the transformation that happens in our lives. And then another story I always tell is when I was 7 years sober, my daughter that had written that letter, that note, and slid under my door, she wrote another note. This one was a letter, and it was actually a nomination for a Father of the Year award for the Inland Empire, which is Riverside and San Bernardino counties, big area. A lot of men were nominated for that. And then people voted based on these letters. And in that letter, she talked about my alcoholism. She didn't hide it. She talked about the struggle that I had. And then she said, but then he went and met these people. And she started talking about how her life started to change. And she talked about the kind of grandfather I was to her sons. And she said, he's the one person I can always count on. She talked about how I coached her in sports and how I took care of her dying mother. She talked about how I was her hero. She described me as her hero. And long story short, when it got to the end, she called me and she said, hey, Dad, you won first place. I got to tell you guys, if I didn't get anything else out of Alcoholics Anonymous, if the only thing I got here was that letter from my daughter, I could never repay you. It is a beautiful letter. And my life is full of those experiences over and over and over. I'm involved with a busy, active group in Alcoholics Anonymous. We live a big life. We go to baseball games and concerts. We saw Mark at a concert recently. And we've been to Akron, Ohio, and saw all the sights there. And we do conventions and road trips. Like, our book says that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And today I get to do all the things that I used to sit on a bar stool and dream that one day maybe I can. I get to do those things today. Okay, so I wound up with 5 grandsons, and I kept asking for a granddaughter. I'm like, where's the granddaughter? I want a granddaughter. My daughter was always daddy's girl, still is to this day. So I just wanted a granddaughter, and I kept requesting, kept getting another grandson. Love them all. They're a blast. I love them. But no granddaughters. And in December, I went to my son's. He moved to Kentucky 2 years ago, and I went to my son's, and my daughter-in-law had asked me to be in the room when their child was born. And on December 13th, I got to stand in the room, and one more time I was looking into the eyes of God. This time they were on the face of my granddaughter, Carla. Finally got my granddaughter. One drink away from missing it. And I'll close with this. When I was in the grips of my illness, at the lowest spot in my life, the person that loved me more than anybody ever had, and probably ever will, looked me in the eyes, told me she loved me, she patted me on the center of the chest and said, "What's in here is good." I don't think that's just true for me. I think it's true for all of us. And it was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave me a little glimpse of what she could always see. Thank you guys so much for that.